Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining this Fireside Chat. I'm Dr. Carolyn Porta. I'm an Associate Vice President here in the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs. I'm a professor in nursing. That's my background, and I'm happy and delighted to be here. And to have with me Dr. Ana Nunez from the Medical School here at University of Minnesota. I'm going to ask her to briefly introduce herself. We're going to ask her a few not so challenging questions that will hopefully promote a little bit of discourse or just casual conversation and just have a good time for a few minutes.
All right. Hi, everybody. Ana Nunez. I'm a professor of medicine and general internal medicine. I'm the vice dean for diversity, equity, inclusion in medical school. I have training in terms of fellowships in medical education, health services research, and health policy, as well as the executive leadership and academic medicine program. Past things I've done, Center of Excellence Director in Women's Health, one of the three Vanguard centers across the US, at the first continuous place where women could be physicians, first female medical college, used to be called MCP, now called Drexel. Also had experience in terms of being invited as a founding editor of a journal, which was a really interesting experience that I sort of had the opportunity to address. Worked in terms of the national space. I'm currently the chair for the Group on Diversity and Inclusion at the Association of American Medical Colleges. And I also serve in our Clinical Translation Science Center as the integration equity officer, as well as the DEIC Catalytic Collaboratory. And nationally, I serve in the NIH in terms of our DEIA, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, Accessibility Enterprise Committee. In terms of sort of the research space. Was born and raised in Altoona, Pennsylvania, which is a nice place to be from, and lived for a very long time in Philadelphia until folks here sort of lured me to Minnesota. And so this will be my fourth year being at the med school in Minnesota. So I'll just stop there and then see if you have questions.
That's great, Dr. Nunez. Thank you. You've done a lot. You have a lot of titles, and with those titles, you have a lot of responsibilities. When you were a second or third year medical student, did you think you'd be where you are today?
No. when I got to medical school, I knew nothing. I was just like, oh, kind of like thinking maybe I should be a neurosurgeon. Seriously. Anatomically, I was actually good at sort of the nerves when it came to sort of dissection. That and becoming a neurosurgeon, of course, is like in a different metaverse. But anyway, so I knew nothing and my aspirations were not associated with reality. As a second year, I think my concerns certainly were at this time of year, you know, studying for boards and sort of, you know, worried and considering like, you know, what would the clinical side be? You know, some said better, some said worse. And so, you know, sort of how was that going to be? So that was sort of my focus then in terms of both being excited and anxious of sort of getting on the floors. I think my focus in medical school was finishing medical school, right? It really wasn't sort of like, it was just like, I need to get done, you know? And you know, I think that there is always this push of, what are you going to be? And you're like, I don't know, right? And so as a second year, a little bit too early for the sneak preview that you have as a third year, where you have sort of the haiku of different specialties and then suddenly have to decide what you want to do for the rest of your life, no pressure. You know, sort of in my third year, sort of did, well, it's not fair to say that I liked everything. There were things I liked a lot. There were things I endured. There were things that I said I should know about this, even though, you know, it's like a place like I don't want to live here, but it's nice to visit, you know, in terms of sort of specialties. So it was good in terms of sort of that exposure. It was hard. It was hard being my one tip. Maybe this is past tense in terms of Lindell and your experience, but for your other colleagues here. One of the things that happens in the surgery clerkship is that, if you're really lucky enough and they sort of let you cut after they've tied it off, they play this game sometimes. Maybe they don't do this in Minnesota. Maybe it's just a Pennsylvania thing. But you're supposed to, they give you the scissors. You're allowed to cut. How exciting. And you cut. And every time you cut, they say it was too short or it's too long or it's too short. And anytime you've cut, even though you keep changing it, it's always wrong. It's too short or too long, right? And so I realized as they played this game, they're just messing with you, basically. Okay. I mean, if you cut the knot and you undo it, you are going to catch all kinds of grief. That's BAD bad. Okay. But in terms of sort of the too short or too long, too short, you could spend all this time messing around, right? So what I did, and for those of you who are second years, and this may be helpful, my strategy to sort of survive is when they do that, I would put the scissors there. And after they sort of mess with me a few times, saying too short and too long, I would then sort of have the scissors and I go like this and say, tell me when to stop. Right. And so then they tell me to stop and I'd cut. And then they couldn't tell me too short or too long because they told me when to stop. Right.
I
There are
love.
strange ways to survive medical training. It's the little things sometimes that sort of like, but as I went through, I sort of, I liked the doing of surgery, but not surgeons. I liked children as people, not as patients. Psychiatry was important to know, but I didn't want to live there. Interestingly enough, even though later on I'd become a center of excellence director for women's health, I didn't want to live at that end of the table all the time in GYN. And so that just, it just,
Yeah.
and we didn't actually have a family medicine rotation, so I didn't actually have exposure to that. So medicine was it. Medicine was sort of like the true nerds. Who like rounding all the time and sort of doing long differential diagnosis and even longer notes. But solving the puzzle, like sort of the story of like, here's a gentleman who has military service, can't tell you or else he'll have to kill you. But he's in all these hot spots that make it sound like he was CIA and he comes in this weird rash that doesn't go away. And you're like, ooh, let's figure this out. Sort of skin TB, what could this be? Right. So when you're nerding out and that's exciting, that probably says you're internal medicine. So that's the direction that I went. And one of the things I did know that I liked to do was actually teach. So when I was a third year, we didn't have X-ray interpretation training. You just, sort of just rounded and sort of just heard what they said or whatever. And so I thought that was kind of ridiculous because if they expected us to read X-rays, shouldn't they at least give her a little, cliff note card to sort of do that? So I made one. And then took it to the program and said, this, I figured this out. This is helpful for me. Would this be helpful for other folks? And they said, well, actually, yeah, it was. And so they laminated it and everybody got to, use this as kind of at least cover these things in terms of chest X-ray interpretation. And it was fun doing sort of education stuff. And that sort of continued in terms of sort of during residency, that sort of that was a piece that I enjoyed in terms of medical education. It was years and years later till I actually did a fellowship in it. But it was sort of something that sort of that was a piece of it. I had the opportunity being selected as chief resident, which was fun in a weird, painful administrative way. but it was good in terms of leadership, understanding people and so on and so forth. When I was on deck to be sort of chief resident, the guys that were ahead of me, they're like, hey, we gave you a great schedule. It's all cardiology all the time. I hated cardiology. And it's just like, what are you doing? Killing me? And he's like, but the chairs, the cardiologists, like, don't care, don't want to be a cardiologist. So it's important to recognize what you like might not be what other people like in terms of doing them a favor. But it was a fun year in terms of sort of learning, how to organize things, run big programs. I oversaw a curriculum about for senior sub eyes in terms of things, and that was part of my job in terms of chief resident, so that was pretty cool. And although I liked different specialties, I liked the whole person. And so people are like, you should be a cardiologist. No, you should be a pulmonologist. No, you should be an oncologist, right? So, I'd sort of go in on pulmonary and I'd say, look at this, look at this finding. And they're like, consult GI. I'm like, but why can't we do it? Right. So I sort of was the whole person approach that kind of appealed to me. And so went in the direction of sort of becoming a general internist, a comprehensivist rather than a specialist. My other chief resident buddy went into GI. And his dream, which maybe he'd actually achieved, was like Monday would be ulcer disease, Tuesday would be diverticular disease, Wednesday. Like that was happy for him. And I thought, oh my God, I would be so bored. Like I really like, patients coming in and just like telling me what's going on. And you're like, wow, let's work this out. You know, that was sort of fun helping them on their journey. So I did general medicine. I realized that there was a colleague who's a year ahead of me. Who said, oh, I'm doing this medical education fellowship. And I'm like, wait, what? So I went to the chair who I'd been meeting with every 2 weeks because I was on the residency program. And I said, I want to do medical education. And he said, oh, I didn't think of you as scholarly. I'm like, wait, what? Thank you. Yeah. It's like, nice. I didn't think of you as a jerk. Okay. But nonetheless, he agreed to fund my medical education fellowship. And so I did that. It was really cool. It was an opportunity across primary care specialties. So I got to learn about general pediatricians and family medicine docs, as well as sort of general internists, which was useful because I became the PI of our Robert Wood Johnson Generalist Initiative program to encourage more people to consider primary care careers. And what was nice is having had the medical education fellowship and trained with folks, I got a better understanding in terms of the headset of pediatricians, of family physicians, and general internists, which although had stuff in common, had things that were really different. And so that was really useful and helpful. So no, I didn't know in terms of the trajectory and sort of just did a little Harry Potter hat sorting of list this, okay, this one, this is, we'll do this kind of thing in terms of general medicine.
What I appreciate about what you've shared though, is that you were really quick to know what you liked and what you didn't like, or you were willing to dive a little deeper to make sure you didn't, that wasn't going to be your passion or your pursuit. I also like hearing that you gained skills in a lot of different ways that more than likely serve you well today, whether it was working with difficult people or communication or the problem solving that you love to do, the mystery solving, all of that comes in handy when you're in various leadership roles, I think. So I love that. You've answered almost all my questions in one answer, but no, you haven't. Let's see if anyone has anything to say, and you can always make a comment or put a note in the chat as well. One of the things I do like to ask is, and it feeds into what you've just said so much. If you were to go back knowing where you are today, is there another skill that you would have worked on or that you think would have been valuable that wasn't maybe put in front of your path? And I'm asking that knowing we have an interprofessional group here, and while your story is your discipline, right? Your path is your journey. The reality is all of us have within our own disciplines, which paths we're going to choose, which specialties, which diseases, which populations we want to work in, where we want to work, rural, urban. So what you're sharing is very applicable. And one of the reasons why I love having different professional people join this chat. So thank you.
So I'll share with you that sort of just the getting to medical school was not actually necessarily a very easy thing. Growing up in Altoona from a pretty traditional Hispanic family, when I said as a nerdy little kid to my parents, I want to be a doctor, my parents said, that's nice, but you can't. And I said, why not? And they said, because that's what the boys are doctors, girls aren't doctors. I'm like, cool, but I want to be a doctor. and they're like, but that's not what girls are. Maybe you could do research or something, but you can't do medicine. I was originally one of five with 17 years between the oldest and the youngest. I was the youngest. So it wasn't until my oldest sister's second child, who is 6 years younger than me, she announced at the dinner table as a little girl that she was going to grow up and become a dentist. That then, because in the court of public opinion in our family, that was okay by my sister, which then made it be that like maybe I could be a doctor. Okay. In terms of sort of, you know, how things went. When I, you know, finished high school and I was looking in terms of colleges, what we used in those days in lieu of the internet was called the public library. And I sort of looked up different colleges because there was no help in terms of like college. And so I sort of did this thing of like, well, maybe if I go to a college that's attached to a medical school, I'll have a better chance of getting into medical school. So I looked at, first I looked at 6-year programs and they weren't loving me. So that wasn't an option. And so then it's interesting in terms of this affiliation, because I'm not kidding, like 2 years ago in the literature, somebody published that you are more likely to go to medical school if you go to one of the top places that actually have articulation agreements with medical school. I'm like, dang, I could have published that at age 17. You know, not that I knew how to publish anything at 17, but okay. But nonetheless, so I actually, my Altoona is very close to Penn State. And my brothers went there and I wanted to go to a liberal arts college. So I convinced, begged, and with scholarship, sort of asked my parents to go to a small liberal arts college because I liked the idea of like, I'm going to nerd out and do science for a long time. Let me sort of learn how to think and have critical thinking and stuff like that. And so I did that. And there, which it was, you know, a useful place in terms of sort of that kind of learning. It also kind of fell down in terms of sort of pre-health advising. So after I took my MCATs, I actually got these solicitations from really prestigious schools to apply to these schools. So I'm like, oh, look at this, look at this. So I take it to my pre-health advisor and I say, look, and he goes, throw it away. I said, wait, what? He goes, throw it away. You'll never get in. I said, but why would they send me something solicitation if they don't want me to apply? And it was hard because, again, I was raised that, like, you know, you respect your elders and he's, you know, ahead of me. He's the boss and he tells you to do this. You have to do it. And I was like, I was that summer working for Project Upward Bound. I don't know if folks know what that program is, but it's an opportunity in terms of socioeconomically sort of challenged folks to be able to bridge the gap and sort of get some experience before they start college. I was the in-residence academic counselor, which probably foreshadowed my medical education career, right? And so the lead was JD, a lawyer. And I went to her and I said, Ann, he told me to throw this away. What do I do? And at this point, you know, she says, well, you know, you talk a lot, so maybe you want to go to law school. And I was just like, oh, Brown versus the fence. Like, I couldn't have a career for that. That would kill me. Like, no. It's like, I want to go to medical school. And so she's like, So I applied, got into 4 places. And years later, when I was the Robert Johnson PI, we had a reception. And it was welcoming all of our preceptors all around the state who were taking our students, encouraging them to go into primary care. And Ralph Rizel was there. There's no HIPAA for people do sort of things to you, so I can just say his name. And so Ralph showed up at this buffet and he's like, Anya, which is not how you say my name. And he goes, so good to see you. I'm like, hi. He goes, I bet you don't remember me. And I sure do. I didn't tell him why. I figure from karma, we didn't need to, but I certainly did remember him in terms of the barrier of sort of, you know, getting in. So it wasn't a clear and easy course. When I did executive leadership and academic medicine program, one of my colleagues sort of told me her coming up story. And so she went to Hopkins and she told the story that her second day of second year, an anesthesiologist gave a lecture and she went to the front and said, that's super interesting. Immediately got in his lab, got a grant by the time she was the end of her third year, had like 12 publications by the time she graduated. And I'm like, is this Hollywood? Does this really happen to people? Like, clearly it does. Some people, not me people, but some people this does. So the world is very different depending on sort of, you know, who you are as you sort of go through these things. And I think sort of that if you say sort of what would I do differently, the one thing I would do with you is, you know, now we talk about work like integration and sort of step away from workaholism. I painfully remember as a second year abusing like literally a pound of coffee right before exams. and being beyond zippity doo-dah in the shower saying, what do you mean? I can't remember this. Ah! Okay. So I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have pulled all-nighters. I would have, you know, studied very differently and so on and so forth. And that would have made life a lot easier in terms of sort of doing that. So that would be nice to sort of go and revisit that. To the question of like, would I go back and, you know, if I had the opportunity in terms of sort of say becoming an MD, PhD, you know, I think that it's, you know, again, it's kind of like it's a different metaverse. A lot of the things that I have done ended up, even though it was pretty circuitous, to inform something else. Medical education and primary care and women's health and leadership. There's all these things because of all the twists and the roads and the opportunities and some of the things of just doing something and giving it a try in terms of doing that, that, you know, I've been really happy in terms of, you know, one of my biggest happiness is sort of mentoring other students along the way and then seeing their success. I worked for a long time in terms of a lot of pipeline programs for folks who were told, you aren't quite what we're looking for in terms of the ability to do something, and worked with them to sort of be able to fit and navigate the system so that, you know, they're sailing and they're doing sort of great stuff. And to me, that's really rewarding because that's how we make it better. Because the only way we make it better is we sort of stick around in the system and say, yeah, there's problems, but we're going to make this better in terms of sort of moving the needle. So I don't think I would have changed anything per se. There are times when you're like, huh, wouldn't it have been nice to know that was an option, you know, to be able to say, no, I don't want to, but at least I knew it was an option. And so I think that's the challenge in terms of when you're first gen is you don't even know what you don't even know what you're saying no to because you don't see all the doors. And one of the things I like to do in terms of the folks that I mentor and work with is like help them see all the doors. They can still say no, but at least they know what they're saying no to in terms of the doors.
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate so much about what you just shared. And I think the others do too. There's a level of vulnerability there. And you know well that when you share your experience, it is helping other people and it is connecting with them in a meaningful way. I'm also a first gen and my pathway was different than yours, but there were also some common blind spots for the very reason that you don't know. Someone's not necessarily there pointing out the path. And I'm not saying others don't have challenges, but there's just challenges. And I appreciate your candor with that a lot. I think it's hard, and I don't know what any of the interns here think. I'm watching your faces, but I believe it's hard in your shoes to be told, find that balance to rest, to get exercise, to get enough sleep, to eat healthily. And yet we're all the first to say, I wouldn't be as much of a workaholic if I could go back and do it. And I'm agreeing with you. That is often the same thing I say. And I think it's hard to actually live out. And so for the interns in the room, I think if you reflect on yourself, your schedule, where you protect me time and where you protect rest time, or whatever that fill in the blank is for you, I would love for you to be able to share those tips and strategies with each other and try to make space to do that because otherwise I think what we see is that you just need to work harder, sleep less, not make time for yourself, say yes to everything. And that's a tough one. I didn't say no to very much early in my career and in my graduate studies, for a lot of different reasons.
Well, you know, the reframe that I found helpful is actually because if you say it's a matter of time, then it's sort of like, how good can you be at scheduling, right? And it's like, I can figure out the schedule. Okay. But I think if you reframe it to actually say there's time is really literally finite, energy is really the focus, right? Because when you think about something that you're really excited about doing, suddenly you find all the time to do it because you're really energized by it. It's sort of something that's all consuming and you're all in. And then the things that you have to do that you don't really want to do, you never really have the time for it, right? But if I think if you focus it on the energy of what gives me energy and then what stuff that really sucks that energy, I still have to do it, but that, and then how do I sort of put that in the menu in terms of the things that gives me energy and the thing that I have to do that really sucks energy, then I think it's a matter of kind of equilibration. There's a really, really old thing. It's like, you know, you can look on YouTube of pie plates and it's this gentleman, I think it's like from vaudeville, and there's these poles and literally pie plates. And he starts spinning. So there's a pie plate on one pole. And then while it's spinning, he gets another one. And then he gets another one. But he has to keep curating them so that they don't all fall. Right. And sometimes I think it's not like, oh, balance. Like that doesn't exist. You know, you're working, you're taking a break, you're working. There isn't like this, you know, sort of this transcendental moment in terms of our lives. I think sometimes it's like the pie plates. It's like we switch it between this and this. And how do we then balance and be aware? How many poles are we, doing here? How much can we do? And when do we sort of say, okay, we're done. We're going to take pie plates down and sort of call it a day thing. One of the things, I've gotten better at over time is just really being mindful about sort of that energy and rest. You know, when are your good times to really focus, whether it's studying or whatever, versus forcing yourself late at night of you keep doing this, but diminishing returns in terms of that? Like, how do you pay attention to your barometer of energy when it's good to do what it is you need to do and match that as best you can? And I think that's really important in terms of the long haul.
I agree 100%. And I know with structured class or work time, that's sometimes to some extent out of people's control. But those things that are in our control, I know absolutely when I am my most creative and when I need to just empty the dishwasher because I'm mindless at that point. Yeah, 100%. Okay, I've got another question or two, and then I think we'll wrap up and enjoy our sunshine. In your current role, you get asked a lot, I'm sure, about diversity, inclusivity, about equity, about the tangible strategies. Would you speak a little bit to your perspectives on being an ally and being an accomplice and what that looks like as a colleague or as a leader?
Sure. Before I get to that, though, I would like to sort of put something out first, because there's lots of stuff and there's lots of noise in the world at large. I will share with you my current favorite four-letter word is VOTE, vote. It's really, really important for sanity's sake, for reproductive justice, for sanity's sake. We need to get people out to vote. Who you're voting for isn't the next bachelor or bachelorette in terms of your mate for life. but people sort of have to pay attention and sort of say it is imperfect and it is messy, but it only works as a participatory democracy. We need to sort of get out and we need to sort of have that sanity. And not just here, but in terms of the influence that you all have in all your spheres of influence. We have friends and colleagues who are really suffering in terms of other states where they live, and they too should get out and vote. Because if we have overwhelming votes in terms of sort of justice and care and so on and so forth, the world would look like a very different place. Judges would be very different people. And sort of what we strive to do in terms of healthcare will be less hampered from government intrusion and things like that. So I'm just, that's my little bully pulpit in terms of please vote, please get people to vote and get them engaged. The literature actually shows the two groups that detach from voting when it comes to smear campaigns and sort of negative ads, the two groups, women and underrepresented minorities, they just say, they're all crooks. I'm not going to do anything. And I envision that like behind the smoke-filled rooms, they're saying, good, the plan's working. Okay, so we need to, like, if it's a smear campaign and it's disgusting, then turn it off or look away. We need to not be distracted in terms of sort of being connected. So I just want to say that piece.
Great.
It's really, it's very important. People have, up is down and down is up. There are forces that are sort of saying bizarre things that are anti-racism, which if you play the English game means you're pro-racist. They're anti-discrimination. Again, the English word, that means you're pro-discrimination. They are against inclusion. They feel that diversity doesn't include everybody, which in our definition, it does. It is everybody in terms of how we all sort of come to the table. And there's, lots of sort of bad actors who are being pretty ridiculous out there. And there are colleagues that I have that are losing their jobs and being told that there's dirty words and letters they can't say, diversity, equity, inclusion. And so it's really bizarre. So again, I think that, getting out, getting the vote, letting people sort of know is incredibly important in terms of how we can sort of progress and move forward. So I think that, the joy of having blind spots is that if you have a pulse and a blood pressure and you're breathing, you have blind spots. It's part of the human condition. We strive not to in terms of stepping into things and not doing it more than once. And so we try to do the best that we can, but sometimes there's things we just don't see or don't appreciate in terms of sort of having an understanding. And I think that a piece of it is coming from a headset in terms of sort of saying, I don't know, but help me understand, and what is it I could do to help? I think that an important piece about sort of being an ally and an advocate is actually coming from, I mean, and honestly, as an internist, I would say some of the smartest doctors I've ever worked with have been able to say, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. The ones who say, I do know, and they don't, they're scary. The ones who sort of say, I don't know, but I'm going to work it through and I'll come back to you on that. It's like that sort of makes you feel very secure. In a similar way, to be an ally, you can't do it unless you know how it's going to help. Helping that isn't helpful isn't helpful. Right, sort of people doing for, speaking for, people that are able to speak for themselves, not helpful. So I think that the question is like, how do you build those relationships and then say, how can I uplift you? What is it that would be useful in this thing? Rather than assume, I think, this needs to be said for you, even though your voice works just fine and you could say it, right? But I'm going to just put it out there for you because I'm an ally. Well, maybe that would work, maybe it wouldn't work, right? But in terms of from a context of humility, asking first of, well, that kind of sucked. What could I do to help? What is it that I could do would be helpful? And asking that question, I think that that's really important. And sometimes you're surprised at the answer because what you're totally sure would be helpful isn't on the plate at all. It isn't something that's wanted. And so that's the piece of the ally of sort of asking and then following through instead of being there. I think that there are times, sometimes in terms of being allies, it's little things. It's not necessarily, sort of big demonstrative things. It's like something bad goes down, and then you say to the person afterwards, poor baby, I'm sorry, that sucks. They're a jerk. Right? And sort of just giving support in terms of that, that just says, I see you, I recognize this, and I'm, to me, that felt really badly, and I'm here, whatever way that I can help. And I think that that stance is really important. I think sometimes we Morse code it and we jump into this is how I'll rescue you, this is what I'll say, or this is what I'll do at you or to you, because I want to do something. And we have to start with it's not about you, it's about them. So ask first, and then sort of uplift and help in a way that is helpful. And I think that's a piece of it. And it's always a an ongoing sort of process in terms of like, I didn't do as well as I wanted to, but next time I will sort of try more in terms of that. So.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that a lot. Looking around, seeing if anyone has anything they want to say or respond to.
Stunned in silence, sorry.
It's great. Usually I end with a recommended book or podcast or something that you find just enjoyable or thought-provoking or riveting of some in some way.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Lessons in Chemistry is a book. Not because I was a chem major, because I was, but actually just, and if you don't want to read the book, there's a TV show, so you could watch that. But I'd really recommend the book. The book is sort of much richer. It's about a talented woman in the 50s, 60s cusp who wanted to become a PhD chemist. And that wasn't a thing. And so it's really good. It's actually funny for those of you who say chemistry. It's actually not really that much about chemistry. It's so the context of sort of being a scientist and whether you can't and gender barriers, which sadly are not necessarily historic and are ongoing. So I think that and it's a fun book. It sort of does make you laugh as well. I mean, make you pissed off a little bit, but makes you laugh. So I would sort of vote for that. There was a weird book, I can't remember the name. I think the author was Couch. There's a thing that I'd never heard of called speculative fiction. It's like I thought all fiction was speculative, but apparently speculative fiction is like an iteration of sci-fi. So it's like physics and that kind of stuff, like super nerdy stuff. But it was a good book. It was by I
Oh.
can't Andrew Couch, I think is the name. So it was really interesting of, you become Schrodinger's cat and sort of commit a crime and stuff. And it was kind of a weird book, but interesting in sort of a nerdy way. So I guess those will be the two that I
Yeah,
would
that's
suggest.
great. How about an app that you love or use too much of?
Oh God, well I'm right there with Minda in terms of overusing my schedule. Like, where am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to be doing? So I think that one, if there was a count in terms of how many times you touch that button for reorientation, I think it would be that. The other is actually sort of, I really do enjoy sunshine. And so, as we get to sort of the solstice and it's like 1 minute more and another minute more, Weather Underground actually, oh, we're past 12 hours. Now we're past 13 hours. Go to 14, go to 15, come on. Right. So I use this in terms of saying, how many hours of sunlight do we have? And then I get a little sad when we go the other direction. But it's all.
Right.
So
Yeah.
we're on the uptick here though. It's like we're gonna be 15 and nobody in no but no time at all. So that one's it's also more reliable than Weather Central or some of the other weather apps. It tends to be a little bit more on the cusp in terms of when things happen. So, I mean, am I not like a good Minnesotan? I'm like obsessed with the weather. Like, isn't that like
Right.
a core thing here, right? So I have adopted well, but no, it's decent that way.
Thank you. That's great. And thank you for your time. I believe that you would welcome any follow-up, an email or a chat from any of the interns. And given that we just have a nice group tonight, I feel like you've given them things to think about and follow up on. And I think some will do that and take you up on it.
Cool. Happy to. I'm on the sixth floor. Send me an email. Happy to visit.
Yeah, that'd be
Sounds
great.
good.
I
Yeah.
feel like you should end up in Iceland when they have 23 and a half hours of daylight and the last half hour is dusk.
No, I was in Iceland during
Yeah.
the solstice. It was the coolest thing. We went on a photography tour. The guy picked us up at 6 o'clock in the evening. Not that you would count 6 o'clock, and we didn't finish till 2 a.m. because the golden hour were many, many hours. And so at 2 a.m. we went back to the little VRBO that was kind of living in an IKEA ad. And we went back there, and it looked like we were going to start to have a little bit of dusk, 2 a.m. 2:30, 3. We're like, oh, and then at like 2:45, it started pinking up again, and sort of went back to
Yep.
daytime. And we were like, wow,
It's
it
so
really cool.
strange. Yeah. So
Solstice top of
strange.
the world is actually a pretty cool thing.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you
All
very
right.
much. Have a great night, you guys. I'll stay on if there's any questions. Otherwise, very grateful for the time tonight.
Yeah, nice meeting you all. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.